For the Lore of the Land, this is Jack Loeffler. By the end of the first quarter of the 19th century, Mexico had wrested its independence from Spain, and by mid-century, the United States had waged the Mexican-American War and subsequently claimed the territory of New Mexico as its own. It's interesting to note that in 1848, then-Congressman Abraham Lincoln had this to say about President James Knox Polk's Mexican-American War, and I quote, "Trusting to escape scrutiny, by fixing the public gaze upon the exceeding brightness of military glory, that attractive rainbow that rises in showers of blood, that serpent's eye that charms to destroy, he plunged into war." Would that we had a person of Abraham Lincoln's caliber on the political horizon today. As the communities in New Mexico grew and evolved, so did traffic along the Camino Real de Tierra Adentro. Stephen Fosberg speaks of the time-honored but illegal practice of smuggling.
I think there's every indication that from its earliest establishment, the Camino Real was used for unofficial purposes or contraband for hundreds of years, and of course continues to be used in that fashion today with problems that we have with drugs and the shipment of certain chemicals, pharmaceuticals, and so on that are outside the law. When the trail was first established in New Mexico, of course, it was supposed to be used only for official purposes, initially to supply the Franciscan missions. But civil authorities immediately saw the advantage of transporting goods along the trail in both directions for profit. And so almost immediately it was used for unofficial and probably illegal purposes, good money to be made in transporting and trading prohibited goods along the trail.
Ventura Rael performs a narrative ballad that tells the story of a smuggler who was caught and imprisoned. The ballad reveals that the smuggler wasn't so unhappy about having been caught, but that he could no longer pursue such a lucrative profession.
Y el bonito, el contrabando, se gana mucho dinero, pero lo que mal me puede, las penas del prisionero. Vísperas de San Lorenzo, como las 11 del día, recumbraban los cumbrales de la penitencería. Unos vienen con un año, otros con 18 meses, otros con un año y un día, y a la penitencería. Vine silbando el tren, ya no tardará en llegar. Yo le digo a mis amigos que no vayan a llorar. Unos vienen con un año, otros con 18 meses, otros con un año y un día, y a la penitencería. Y ahí te mando, mamacita, y un suspiro y un abrazo, pa' que cantes las mañanas del contrabando del paso.
J. Paul Taylor is an historian whose sense of the Camino Real and the Santa Fe Trail is profoundly affected by stories of his ancestors, who were traders who used the trail to transport goods over long distances. Here, he tells of one ancestor who found himself in a real pickle.
Manuel Salustiano Delgado had gone on a trading expedition to St. Louis and Kansas City, and coming back, on the trail, he died of cholera. Well, with him was this wonderful Indian servant whose name was Susano Leyva. So here they were in this vast prairie land. They had to bury him because it was the middle of summer. So Susano Leyva got the lay of the land. They dug a hole. They filled the base with charcoal. They wrapped him in burlap, and they saturated him, his body, with brandy. And then they covered him up. And so the object was that Susano Leyva would remember exactly where he was buried, which would have been, I would think, quite a feat. And they went back to Santa Fe without Don Manuel. And when winter set in, his family went back for him with Susano Leyva, and they disinterred his body. And they unwrapped this burlap. This was the middle of winter. And they found this almost perfect, preserved body of Manuel Salustiano Delgado.
Mike Marshall points out an interesting landmark south of Socorro.
One thing is the Camino Real being used as a stock driveway. New Mexico had big sheep growers up here. That was one of their main exports, where they were shipping the sheep into northern Mexico. Well, when they got down right before the Jornada de Muerto, what a difficult part to take them through, there's a mesa right across from San Marcial, the black mesa there, that same black mesa. Well, they'd run the sheep right along the edge of the mesa in the river, and then they'd count them and keep a tab there. And that's why that mesa shows up on all the old maps as Contadero, the counter. If you look at all the old maps, it's Contadero Mesa. Then it starts off as Mesa Guiana, then it goes to Mesa Sinuco, then it goes to Contadero, then it goes to San Marcial Mesa, and now it's called Black Mesa. It's right across from Fort Craig there. And so they count them in there, and that's why they call it Contadero, the counter. So somebody would be sitting there counting these sheep, and then they'd go into the Jornada, and presumably a lot of them didn't come out of the other side. But it's a real interesting little feature along the Camino.
Mike Marshall tells of a benighted expedition where Texans' attempt to take over New Mexico met with disaster.
In the 1840s, there was this Texas Santa Fe expedition. The Texans decided Texas was going to extend to the Rio Grande. So they decided they'd come up here and see if they could take New Mexico. And they sent a band up here of volunteers, and various people came in here. And it didn't work so good, because by the time they got to New Mexico, they were all beat up. They got captured. They were assigned to a Captain Demasio Salazar and a band of Mexican dragoons. And this is 1841, and they headed down the Camino Real, some 200 captives of the Texas Santa Fe expedition. And they were having some pretty hard times. They were treating them pretty badly. As they went along the Camino Real and they went through these little towns in New Mexico, the people along the way felt real sorry for them and were giving them food. But a lot of them didn't have shoes, and some of them were dying along the way. It was pretty bad. And along on the expedition was this journalist by the name of Kendall. He wrote a diary of it, Kendall's Texas Santa Fe expedition here. They were coming into the Jornada de Muerto. They camped at this paraje on the river, and that night it snowed on them. And in the morning they woke up and everybody's underneath these blankets, and Kendall kind of looks out and just sees all these humps out there covered with snow and coughing coming underneath them and everything. And then the Mexicans going around kicking them, getting them up, you know, and saying, okay, now. And they told them that they were going to march them through the whole Jornada, 90-mile walk, straight march. So they took off and they walked all day long, and people are dropping along the way and they're picking them up, and a couple, three of them don't make it through. One of the first nights they're walking along, and it's cold out there and the ground's all covered with snow, and they're stumbling down this long, dark Jornada de Muerto trail. And he writes in his journal here, about 9 o'clock at night, we met a regiment of dragoons under Colonel Munoz on their way from Durango to Santa Fe. These were soldiers coming north. Many of them were leading their horses and setting fire to every little tuft or palm or dry grass. Around these blazing tufts and scattered along the road for miles were to be seen knots of half-frozen dragoons mingled with a large number of women who always follow the Mexican soldiery on the march. Wild and picturesque was the scene presented by the train of roadside fires, each with a little bevy huddling and shivering around the red glaring and fitful lights, the long and flitting shadows coming and going and losing themselves in the somber obscuration of night. The palmilla yucca would suddenly flare up, blaze for a few moments, and then suddenly expire. The wild group would hurry on to others and soon kindle them. Faces came and vanished on that barren moor that did strongly remind me of the witch scenes in Macbeth. So it was a wild time going down that Camino that night. And he continues to describe this journey and the sufferings and the horrors of that dreadful night on Dead Man's Journey.
The Mexican-American War began in 1846 and resulted in the U.S. takeover of New Mexico by the Army of the West under the command of General Stephen Kearny. New Mexico was made an official territory of the United States in 1850. Several years later, the American Civil War found its way to El Camino Real de Tierra Adentro.
To me, the Battle of Valverde is a story that really does need to be told because it was the largest Civil War engagement in the West. When the Confederates marched up, of course, they were assuming a couple of things which proved to be wrong. They assumed that New Mexicans would open their arms and welcome them, and the bad feelings between New Mexico and Texas were well established way back then. So one thing, the local population didn't embrace them and draw them to their bosom. Secondly, the local population didn't have a lot of spare enchiladas and food to give the troops. So there weren't local supplies to be had to supply this army. So they were really dependent on the supplies they brought along in the wagon trains. They couldn't either buy or live off the land like they thought they could. So when they marched north and they got to Fort Craig, word had arrived that they were coming, of course, and Fort Craig was quite a big fort, well-stocked. And they kind of surrounded it and were hoping that the troops would come out to fight. Well, the troops wouldn't come out to fight. They just had better sense and stayed holed up. Despite that, there was the Battle of Valverde, where troops eventually did engage north of the fort. And the significant thing about that campaign was that not the number of casualties so much as the fact that about half the wagon trains were destroyed in that engagement. And that proved to be really crucial. After that battle, the troops of New Mexico retreated back to the fort, and the Confederates marched on, leaving the fort intact to their rear. They took over Albuquerque, they took over Santa Fe, which was under Confederate control for a while, and then they marched to the northeast, still hoping to get up to Colorado eventually. Well, it was at Glorieta that they lost the second half of their wagons. And at that point, they had no way to supply the troops, so they had to retreat. And at that point, the battle was over. But in many ways, it was already inevitable that they couldn't succeed when they lost half the wagons at Valverde. So, you know, the Camino Real played a crucial role in that Civil War engagement. After the burning of the second half of the wagon train up at Glorieta, the Confederates realized they had to retreat. And so they marched down one side of the river on the more recent Camino Real routes, which were established on the west side of the river only in more recent times. The Union forces were on the old Camino Real, and they marched down in parallel, camped across the river from each other at night, called to each other across the river, yelled insults and greetings across the river. The Union forces didn't want to capture the Confederates because they couldn't possibly feed them and take care of them. They just wanted to shoo them out of the state and flush them back to Texas, and so that's what they did. They just marched in tandem. And eventually the Confederates got back to Texas. I would just love to have seen that scene of campfires across the river at night, knowing full well where the troops were, and the Union making no attempt to capture them, just making sure they left. But it was on the Camino Real that they came up, and it was on the Camino Real that they retreated.
While the Civil War was being bitterly fought north of the border, Mexico was undergoing great turmoil with the proclamation of Maximiliano as emperor in 1863 by the Emperor Napoleon III of France and a group of Mexican conservatives who wanted to overturn the liberal government of Benito Juarez, the duly elected president of Mexico. Enrique Lamadrid tells the following story.
One of the truly heroic episodes of the Camino Real de Tierra Adentro was Benito Juarez. As he was coming north in his famous black carriage, he fled Mexico City basically when the French army, sent over here by Napoleon III to take over Mexico, to abolish the republic and install a monarchy, which they did, Maximiliano, the emperor. When they prevailed in the south, the democratically elected government had to flee. So there came Benito Juarez with a wagon train of the entire National Archives of Mexico coming up the Camino Real. They managed to stash all of those papers at an hacienda for safekeeping. And Benito came north as the French army followed. He came north along the age-old route up through Zacatecas, Durango, eventually to Chihuahua. The actual capital of Mexico was Chihuahua for at least a couple of years when he was there directing the affairs of state from a house not far from the plaza. Another great sight must have been all the socializing that the liberals were so fond of doing. The liberales scheduled regular parties and soirees, music, poetry reading, declamation, speeches. The house where Benito Juarez stayed was a social center. There was constant socializing there. Of course, all of the citizens of Chihuahua were welcome there. There was music, there was dancing. I like to think that a lot of those new European dances and tunes that Maximiliano brought to the capital, I think they were brought north by Benito Juarez and people like him, because the people up here wanted to hear that new music. They wanted to learn these new dances, and the liberales were certainly giving plenty of parties. Eventually, the French army gets as far as Chihuahua. Benito Juarez flees again to El Paso del Norte, where he directs again the affairs of state from a little house that's off the plaza just to one side of the old catedral. It's now a unisex beauty salon with a little plaque on it. People forget why Ciudad Juarez is named Ciudad Juarez. It's because it was the capital of Mexico. If the French had managed to capture Juarez, that would have been the end of the Mexican Republic. To this day, you can hear little girls jumping rope in places like El Paso and Las Cruces, using rhymes that celebrate the defeat of the French, the execution of Maximilian, the Empress Carlota fleeing to Europe. She goes crazy after he's killed. Benito Juarez had Maximiliano executed, not because he was a pitiless, vengeful president, but because Maximiliano himself had instituted a law which drafted every Mexican man, every able-bodied male from teenage years to the 40s. And if they pulled into your town and you were between those ages and you weren't in the army, they could execute you. And they did execute many hundreds of young men in Mexico. And there was no pity shown to them. Juarez wasn't about to show any compassion for Maximiliano, even though he was a great guy and he loved Chile and he tried to learn about Mexican culture and all of that. His shirt, with all the bullet holes in it, is still on display in the National Museum.
Further north, Apache raiders continued to take their toll in the communities near the Rio Grande. Juan de la O sings of Vittorio, who, with Geronimo and Cochise, was greatly feared.
Yo soy el indio Vittorio, mi profesión es matar, es mi vida y es mi gloria, hacer al mundo temblar. Quiero morir, quiero vivir, no quiero morir sin mi deber. Vittorio empuñó su espada para combatir el Estado. Varias vidas me tomé y hay también algún ganado. Quiero morir, quiero vivir, no quiero morir sin mi deber.
North of the border, efforts were being made to establish a transcontinental communication system with the telegraph. Mike Marshall recounts how the presence of the Camino Real contributed to this effort.
When the telegraph came in to this part of the country, you know, it first came in from the east, and it finally made it to Santa Fe, 1870s. It had come out of San Diego, and it made it over to Tucson. But the intervening countryside and all the military forts in the area and everything were outside of telegraph communications. Congress made in another appropriation, probably right around 1875, to join that country. And they assigned a fella, and he started building this telegraph line, and they started building out from Tucson, and he started building down from Santa Fe. And the Santa Fe route followed the Camino Real. And it would, you know, I mean, you're going to go out and you're going to drop posts, and you're not going to drop them out anywhere, or you're going to drop them along the road, you know, with no railroads. So the first telegraph went down the Camino Real, and I found pieces of, like, posts and old insulators. They were really different in those days, the insulators, along the Camino Real in places. I believe they joined out there somewhere out by Fort Cummings. They joined the two lines, and it was pretty quick because they got a lot of local people were interested in it, too, because they wanted to call, Apaches are coming, you know, like, come on down there. Everybody wanted that communication. So they joined it over there, I think it was in the 1875, 1876 period, and then we had sort of transcontinental telegraph communication, I guess you could call it.
It was possible to follow different routes from the plains south of Santa Fe northward to the capital. One followed the Santa Fe River, another went east through the Galisteo Basin, and yet another was carved into the precipitous La Bajada Hill. Mark Simmons tells us more.
Apparently, it was easier to come down on the road, the main road off La Bajada, west of the interstate. It's 2 or 3 miles west of the interstate, where the old switchback road is that the Model T's used up through the 20s. I got records in the 19th century of wagons and even stagecoaches going down that, but I don't think generally they went up. I think they followed up the Santa Fe River Canyon. If you go to the mouth of the Santa Fe River Canyon there at La Bajada Hill, just by the little village of La Bajada, you can see ruts coming out of there of the tracks, and then you can see the ruts out on crossing the plains of the Camino Real coming out of that canyon. Certainly, if you were coming north, you would take that canyon, and probably some of the people coming south did too. The advantage of taking the route on top, if you're coming south, is that it's flat most of the way and you can make good time. The river in the canyon continually curls back and forth across the road, so you're continually fording the little Santa Fe River. But if the river is down, and as it is ordinarily, the river wasn't much impediment. You continued to cross back and forth. It was more direct, it was easy, and you avoided that steep climb up to the top. It rose rather precipitously, but it was an easy grade and very easy on animals.
Elephant Butte Dam was completed in 1916 and was the first major dam to be constructed on the Rio Grande. It is visible from Highway 51 that extends from Truth or Consequences eastward to the tiny hamlet of Engel, which lies in the heart of the Jornada del Muerto. The dam resulted in an enormous storage reservoir that transformed agriculture in the Mesilla Valley further south, where floods had formerly made predictable farming all but impossible. Ironically, it was because of this dam that the thriving upstream town of San Marcial was doomed by flooding in 1929 and again in 1937. Bernie Romero and Bobby Olguin performed the well-known ballad composed by Ramon Luna entitled El Corrido de San Marcial.
Marcharse para el paso o quedarse en San Marcial. mi gente. Ay, qué suerte les tocó. Todas sus casas perdieron. No más el Harvey quedó. Ay, qué lástima de pueblo. Cómo quedó destrozado por el medio de las calles. Lomas de arena a los paisanos de aquí. Voy a decirles mi nombre pa' que se acuerden de mí. Pues mi nombre es Ramón Luz. Nacido de aquí, es por eso que me duele la plaza donde nací. Ya voy a despedirme, las gracias les voy a dar. Y acabo el corrido del final de San Marcial.
The Lore of the Land is sponsored by the Museum of New Mexico Foundation and the New Mexico Department of Cultural Affairs. This segment is funded by a grant from the United States Bureau of Land Management with the ongoing support of the Ford Foundation. For The Lore of the Land, this is Jack Leffler. Thank you for listening.